Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here and a real honor to be asked to give this lecture. And I'd like to start by also echoing congratulations to Ed Sondick, one of my heroes, and my fellow Stanford graduate, John Story, as well as particularly the student awardees. And thank you so much for inviting me. So my talk is called Big Statistics in Policy and Politics, and I'm going to explain what I mean by big statistics as we move through this talk. Let me just get this going here so I can look at some notes. So I was asked to give speaker disclosures. I'm on a committee for HRQ, the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, also American Statistical Association, as you heard, PCORI. I'm funded by a couple of agencies as well as the National Pharmaceutical Council. I'll speak about one of the NPC projects today. So Lowell Reed, I started, there he is, you saw a picture of him before. Here's me, and I thought, are there any connections? So I've always admired Lowell Reed, of course. You heard a little bit about his career. So the first connection, do we know what this is a picture of? It's the Johns Hopkins Dome. There are some connections. My family actually came to this country because of Hopkins. My father was invited to be an intern there, and he wrote a book, you can read it, An English Doctor in America. And then later in her career, my mom was actually the first woman dean in the School of Medicine, the dean of primary care in the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. When I was 12 years old, I was a candy striper at Johns Hopkins because my mom was there. A candy striper is a volunteer. They're called that because they had candy striping uniforms. Those were out of date by the time I was a volunteer, but I was a candy striper, and I worked on some data in sudden infant death syndrome, SIDS, and maybe that's why I became a statistician. That was my first experience with data. This is a picture of the Pitt Graduate School of Public Health, and it turns out when it was being established, Lowell Reed actually led the committee that established the School of Public Health at the University of Pittsburgh. And then, of course, Lowell Reed was also a president of the American Statistical Association in 1951. And as you heard, I was fortunate to be the president in 2009. So I was pleased to see there were some connections between Lowell Reed and I, and I'm so honored to be giving a lecture in his honor today. So of course, since he was president of ASA, I had to read his presidential address. This is a watershed moment for any president. I remember mine. And this is his. It was titled, Man as a Planning Animal. And I just wanted to underline a quote there where he talks about encouraging the statisticians of the future, that's us now, this was written in 1951, to not just do analysis, but also do synthesis. And what I'm going to do today is talk about some examples from my work as a statistician in health policy, and I hope you'll see that we focus on synthesis. So perhaps if Lowell Reed were sitting here, he'd be interested in the talk today. So here are two quotes that I like as I think about being a statistician in health policy. One is by Peter Orszag. He was director of the Office of Management and Budget early in the Obama administration. He said that policy decisions should be driven by evidence. And then there's a quote at the bottom by Janet Norwood, also a former president of the ASA and the first woman commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, who sadly died last year. And she said, statistics is an integral part of public policy. What I'm going to try to do today is encourage you to continue to have an impact on policy as statisticians. So here's a couple of documents that I've read you might be interested in, the book, The Honest Broker. Scientists are being asked by policymakers to contribute more directly to the needs of society. And there was an article in the New York Times in 2014 that also challenged scientists to be directly part of policy. I think at times we feel that we must hold ourselves apart so that we don't become biased and become advocates. But at the same time, I think at times that's limited our effectiveness because we haven't been good communicators in the policy setting. It's important to remember when you get involved in policy, to remember the clock speed of politicians. It's very, very slow, and then suddenly there's a focus on what you're doing. And I'll say a little bit about that in my second example today. You have to remember that policy clock speed. We tend to go more uniformly as statisticians. The project goes on, but there's focus in policy, you have to remember that. And also to have impact, you need to think about what is the precision by which the policy decision needs to be answered. It's not always as precise as we're used to as scientists. Often a yes-no answer is what they need to know. So two things to keep in mind. Okay, so now we get to big statistics. I don't know about you, but I'm getting a little tired of big data. And we hear it all the time. It's the big answer to everything. More seriously, though, I actually like the term all data, which is a term that was used in Science magazine. I see some nodding heads. It's not just about the data being big. It's actually about the data being different. So we have genomics data. Dr. Story is an expert in that. I'm sure we have others in the room. And then we have social network data. We have electronic medical record data. We have geographic data. It's not just that it's big. It's that it's amorphous in all different types. And we statisticians need to be able to integrate that together. So first, I thought we needed big statisticians. Now, I'm 5'11", but I was thinking maybe not the best term, so I thought big statistics. So what are big statistics? I think it means us and also teaching our students to do this, to get involved early in the process of a project. I'm always counseling my graduate student researchers, if you're waiting until analysis, it's too late. 40% missing data, babe, I can't fix it. Fix it in the field. So get involved early, be part of the design. That's how you can have the most impact and get in on the publications. I think you need to collaborate with scientists, communicate. That's a very important part of education, of course, now. We have a communication class in my department, Department of Biostat at Pitt. I give a talk to students on professionalism and getting a job because I've had all these different jobs, so they're always asking me. And I tell them the single most important skill that employers look for is communication. Without a doubt, doesn't matter what sector you're in, if you're in industry, government, or academics, communication. Acknowledge the politics. This doesn't happen in a vacuum. If you're being involved in policy. And I also think we need to be leaders, and the ASA, of course, has really focused on this. There's leadership courses at JSM and so on. And that means really stepping up, being at the table, being part of the discussion. I think at times we're a discipline that says no. We say no a lot. No, not big enough sample size. No, you can't do it that way. No. We need to learn how to say yes. I don't mean indiscriminately, of course, but how to say yes and see as people that help solve a problem. And I see people doing that all the time. I want us to do big statistics and make a difference. So I'm going to try to give you some examples of big statistics in my career. There will be three examples. Oh, but first, I know what you're thinking. Wait, I went to graduate school to be a statistician. What is this about big statistics? So I always bring out this example. You may have seen it before. Now, the New England Journal is a very serious journal most of the time. But this is an article that appeared in 2012, and I hope you can see it. What you have down here is chocolate consumption per capita. And here you have the number of Nobel laureates per 100,000 population. And the countries are the flags, okay, you can see this. And so very strong positive correlation. To those of us who like chocolate, this is a good outcome, okay? And we see, this is Switzerland up here. They eat a lot of chocolate, a lot of Nobel laureates, okay? Now, where is the outlier on this plot? Right up here, right, Sweden? Now, you're thinking to yourself, why did that happen? Okay, so two hypotheses. The first one, do we have any Swedish people here? From Sweden? Okay, well maybe those of us who are Swedish, when we eat chocolate, it's just a bigger bang for the buck, okay? They don't need to eat as much chocolate to have as many Nobel laureates as Switzerland. Or what is an alternative hypothesis? Lots of Swedes on the Nobel laureate committee, they're voting in their people. So, of course, what's the problem here? Well, ecological regression, that is a problem, but correlation is not causation. I know it's not. And guess what? The world needs this explained, and you are the people that need to explain it. So do big statistics and explain this. If you teach a basic regression class, this is a lovely example to show your students. But anyway, so I know you went to graduate school to be a statistician, and I'm saying widen your view of what a statistician is. So now I'm going to go through my three examples. The first has to do with Medicare spending. This is a Dartmouth map. The folks at Dartmouth have done a lot of these maps. You actually saw them in the New York Times during healthcare reform debate and so on. Obviously, you have the country. It's difficult to see the legend. I apologize. The darker colors are the higher spending per capita. These are age, sex, and health adjusted. They're adjusted figures. So what you're seeing is a lot more spending in the South in particular. So the question was, and there was an IOM committee, I served as a member, the IOM committee was asked those two questions down the bottom right. How does healthcare spending vary across geographic regions? And should, this is a policy question, should Medicare provider patients be adjusted regionally? What that means is people in the South, providers in the South, would be paid more money for a particular procedure than people in different parts of the country. Now, there's obviously geographic variation, and it represents either what would be called acceptable or unacceptable reasons. Acceptable reasons would be that people in a certain part of the country are sicker, so they need more care, higher smoking rates, more elderly people there, whatever reasons. Unacceptable would mean inefficient use of services. And there's things in the gray area. A gray area would be we haven't agreed on how, in particular, we should treat a particular condition. So one part of the country, they might be doing one thing that costs more than another part, but we don't agree on what the right treatment is. So this committee did a large amount of analysis. We used contractors to do this. What you should see on this chart is that synthesis that Lowell Reed was talking about. So we did analysis of Medicare data. We had a commercial data set, the Thomson Reuters market scan data. If you work in health policy, you'll know about this one. We looked at Medicaid services, and we also synthesized data on the uninsured, because the uninsured patients are the ones that wouldn't occur in those other data sets. And our recommendation was Congress should not adopt a geographically based value index for Medicare. I'm going to go back a slide. You can see that the title of our IOM report, there's a lot of money, of time spent in the IOM committees on the title. You know, crossing the quality chasm. You know, you want a catchy title. So ours was target decision making, not geography. That was supposed to be catchy. So there it was. So it was a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun to work on IOM committees. You really feel like you're having an impact. But the key thing about this experience was this idea of synthesizing and calibrating across different data sets, because none of these data sets uniquely can represent all the people. So my lesson here was calibrate and synthesize data sources, triangulate findings. So that's my first example. My second example has to do with ephedra. Ephedra is an herb, okay, it's a plant. Ephedrine is the active body in ephedra. Public Citizen, which is an advocacy group, asked the Health and Human Services Secretary, Tommy Thompson, at that time in the early 2000s, to ban ephedra sales in the United States. Ephedra in the United States at that time was used to enhance athletic performance and to lose weight. It's also used in Chinese traditional medicine. It's used in Germany for things like colds and lung conditions. But in this country, it was used for athletic performance and weight loss. There was a death of the Baltimore Orioles pitcher Steve Belcher, who was a young man, in 2003, and ephedra was implicated in his death. There's a quote from the Medical Examiner. So what we did, and this is when I was still at RAND, part of the Southern California Evidence-Based Practice Center, we conducted a meta-analysis of the clinical trial data. I won't talk about that here. That's fairly constrained. Those are short trials, 1 to 3 months in duration. We also looked at the adverse event data, which is reported to the FDA. So this is where you're taking ephedra, or your friend is, your spouse is, something happens, you pick up the phone and you call the FDA and you report an event. That's how these events are reported. Also, Metabolife. Metabolife was a maker of ephedra products. They had a similar adverse event database. Actually, their database was obtained via a court order. Okay, so we have these two databases. Now, just as we were sort of starting this analysis, think to yourself that this other event occurs. So this is another baseball pitcher who's 33 years old, Darrell Kyle, and he also died. So the question is, in the back of your mind is, did ephedra, was he taking ephedra to enhance his athletic performance, and did this kill him? So what we did with those adverse events is we tried to classify the events. Example, a death, a seizure, a heart attack, these are the events that are being reported, into what are called sentinel events and possibly sentinel events. What sentinel events are, number one, you know the event occurred. You know the person died. Okay, there's a death certificate. You know they had a seizure. There's documentation that the person took ephedra within 24 hours before the event occurred. And the third point is the really sticky one. You can document that all other possible causes could have been excluded. So the person didn't have heart disease, and that's why they died. Ephedra works like an amphetamine, like speed. So you see a lot of heart racing, heart attacks. That's how people are dying from ephedra. Okay, so let me show you some of the events. This is an FDA MedWatch case report. It was classified as a sentinel event. So the first thing to notice is this is a young person, 22 years old. It shouldn't be dying like this. She had a history of asthma. She was taking Slacker 2. They had all these names like Slacker 2. This was an ephedra product for athletic performance. There was no other cause of death. This is called an idiopathic event. You have excluded all other possible causes of death except the taking of ephedra. This was classified as a sentinel event. Here's a possible sentinel event. So this person, again, quite young at 38. However, he had triple vessel coronary artery disease. So he's taking the ephedra, has the heart attack, dies, could have been the ephedra, but could have been this pre-existing condition. So this is a possible sentinel event. Here's insufficient information to address. You can't read it, neither could we. Okay, so we had 18,000 of these. They came in as PDF files. We had a team of six nurses doing double data extraction. You can't read this because basically what happened here is the person at Metabolife picks up the phone and scribbles on this piece of paper what happened. You might see one word, let's see if I can, seizures, but you can't discern from this. There isn't enough information. In the other cases that are reported to FDA, we can actually get hospital records and look for the autopsy and look for the effect. So this is an insufficient event. So here's the table of all the events. Look at the first row, death. So there were 84 deaths reported in those 18,000 case reports. 80% had insufficient information, 5 were sentinel events, 12 were possibly sentinel. This number 5 banned ephedra in the United States. You can no longer buy ephedra in the United States. You can buy ephedra on the internet from Canada. They have it shipped to you here in the United States, but you cannot buy in the United States. It's outlawed. This number banned ephedra, for all intents and purposes. Now, it's very interesting. We're here at public health meeting. What's missing? The denominator. 5 is tragic. These were young people, as you saw, but we have no, you know, there's nothing about risk here, relative risk at all. It's important to remember that herbal supplements like ephedra are not regulated in the same way drugs are by the FDA. They are assumed to be safe. The scientific standard used to overturn this assumption of safety is to demonstrate unreasonable risk. So in this case, the FDA published this final rule prohibiting the sale of ephedra based by saying risks are unacceptable in light of any benefits of these products. Now remember Kyle? He died. People thought it was ephedra. Turned out he had a pre-existing heart condition, and that was thought to be the cause of his death. Not true for Belcher, which was the first pitcher who was found to have taken ephedra, and everything else was excluded in his case. So communicating with the press. So we were vilified in blogs. I got called by the ephedra lobby. We were sued. I got served by the ephedra lobby because they sure as hell didn't want ephedra to be banned. And I got called a lot. One of the things I learned here is to really focus on a small number of conclusions and try to anticipate what the spin was. So let me give you an example of spin. The ephedra lobby completely ignored the adverse event analysis. They focused on the meta-analysis, which I didn't show you. There were no deaths in the meta-analytic data. These were short trials, most of them on weight loss. There were about 1,200 patients in total across all the trials. If you do the power calculation, with any reasonable rate of death, you have to have a lot more patients than 1,200 to have 80% power to actually see one death. But they focused on, look, there are no deaths in the trial, Ephedra is safe. So that was their spin. The other thing that I learned here is that statisticians were very averse to the N of one. We don't want to talk about the anecdote, that's not what we do. But actually here, if you can find a story that you can illustrate what you're doing to the press, you're way better off. I use Kyle as my story, because Kyle was such a good demonstration of a case and try to think about what is a sentinel event, that I could use that to begin the story with, say, a journalist, and then turn it to the science. So that's one of the things that I learned. But it was a bit like being in a firestorm, being part of this analysis. Okay, and there's an article I wrote in Statistical Science. It was part of an issue that was commemorating Daryl Huff's How to Lie with Statistics. So I did the Ephedra example there in Statistical Science. So my last example is about PCORI. So PCORI is the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, which was established in healthcare reform. It's a public-private partnership, and their watchwords are doing research differently. So up till now, think about this analogy. We're in the front seat of a car, we're the researcher, and the patient sits in the back, and we say, we are driving to Chicago. We pick the research questions, the outcomes, we drive to Chicago. Now the patient sits in the front row, and they say, we don't want to go to Chicago, we want to go to Pittsburgh. So now the patient is not just, is no longer a subject or a participant, they're a partner in the research. We know about community-based participatory research. This is another branch, patient-centered outcomes research, is words that we're hearing now at PCORI and elsewhere. One of the things that PCORI has to do, it's legislated to do, that is in the legislation. If you read the healthcare reform legislation, 976 pages, and you find the 5 pages in which PCORI is established, you will see that the PCORI methodology committee, which I'm a member, you heard, has to establish standards for doing patient-centered comparative effectiveness research. They have to do it. It's going to be done, whether we're part of it or not. And I'm going to try to make the case that we should be part of it as a community. Here's an example of a standard, and I've picked a particularly statistical one. The first thing to know is that PCORI standards are not aspirational, they're kind of low bar. So this says don't do single value imputation, which we already know as statisticians. There are 47 standards that were established. We're actually updating them now. I used to be really bothered by standards. I thought, who are you guys to tell me how to do statistics, right? I mean, that's the first thought that comes to you. The second thought is, what are we, the statistics police? You know, I mean, it just seems what is this about? But I've actually decided they're going to be done, and I feel they are a voice of our community, both within our community and outside our community, to help others that may not have had the training that we have, to help bring up the standards of science and improve evidence for policy. So I see them as an educational voice piece, if you will. One of the studies that we just finished, it says under revision at JCE, Journal of Clinical Epidemiology, but it just got accepted a couple days ago, so it'll appear soon, is we decided to do a project to try to compare and contrast standards for doing, like the PCORI methodology standards, as well as guidelines for reporting. Guidelines are things like the consort statement for clinical trials or the PRISMA statement for meta-analyses. If you're going to publish your clinical trial in JAMA, you have to follow the consort statement. That's a guideline for reporting. Standards for doing are things, here's what you should do as you're doing your study. Guidelines for reporting basically are trying to get you to do the right thing, right? They're saying, if you want to get published, you're going to have to report this, so let's hope you do it. They're kind of a backwards, retroactive, if you will, retrospective way to get you to do things. So here's what we did. We did systematic review. This is a PRISMA flowchart following the PRISMA standard statement. And we came up with 9 standards or guidelines. These are standards or guidelines for observational studies writ large. They're not about particular case control studies or cohort studies. They're about all kinds of observational studies, which is a very broad brush, I agree. Some of you may recognize some of these standards. There's GRACE, there's NCEP, that's a pharmacoepidemiology group in Europe. The E stands for Europe. There's the FDA, there's AHRQ. So what we did, I'm just trying to show it to you pictorially, is think of a big Excel chart, okay, Excel table. The rows are steps in an observational study. So there you see review of prior research, the first thing you might do. The columns, the nine columns, there's one for each standard. And then we just looked at the standards and guidelines, which were anything from a single sheet to pages, hundreds of pages of documentation. We tried to pull out the piece that pertained to that step. So here you see me pulling in the methodology standard by PCORI that pertains to review of prior research. When you get this big table, and we printed it out on big poster side boards, stuck it around my office and went, okay, what do we do now? You know, we were trying to simplify it. You have empty cells and you have to think about what that means. So let me show you the results. I'm gonna skip this, I'm just gonna go to the summary table. So the green boxes are where there are 7 to 9 standards or guidelines that address that element and they agree about what to do. So an example is study objectives, research questions. 8 of the 9 standards or guidelines say you should do something about that, mainly state them a priori, and they agree about what to do. The blue entries are 7 to 9 guidelines or standards say you should do something about it, but I don't think they agree. That's blue. So they're saying do something, but they don't necessarily agree. Now the yellow are 4 to 6 address it. So only 4 to 6 address, actually 6 it says there, review of prior research. 3 of the standards or guidelines are silent on whether you should review prior research and what to do when you review it. And red are 3 or less address it. So just look at that for a bit. What we'd like to see, I think, but we could debate, is a lot more green. Okay. Now, why might these differ? So there's limitations here. If a cell is empty, what does that mean? So a standard or guideline did not address a particular element or step in an observational study. It may represent a lack of agreement, or perhaps that particular group thought that element wasn't important. Also, these standards or guidelines are directed at very different audiences. One is in the pharmacoepi type of world, and then you've got PCORI and patient-centered CER, and you've got AHRQ, FDA, very different audiences. There was very different format. GRACE is a checklist. Did you review the prior research? Yes or no? You know, that's the GRACE. That's what GRACE addresses. They're very, very short. Others, very long, pages and pages. Now, here's the question. You've got 9 leading international standards or guidelines that don't seem to agree. So the first question is, if you and I did our research, the exact same study, and I followed GRACE and Ofer followed PCORI, would we reach a different conclusion? That's problematic. And furthermore, if we followed different standards and the public heard about that, would they think that we're being true? Would they believe our results? That's problematic. Is it a good idea to have more than one set of standards? Maybe. Maybe we should have a set of very important steps that everybody should agree on. Maybe there's a subset of steps we should all agree on. If we think that we should harmonize standards, how are we going to do that? Who's going to pay for it? Who's going to update them? Who has the heft to make people harmonize? So this is all raised in the paper. The last point, number 8, might bother you as a methodologist. Will standards stifle innovation? We have standards for missing data. Why would we ever have to do further research on missing data? It's a solved problem. That's a question that often comes up. Again, I'm a little more pragmatic. People are setting these standards. So my response is carpe diem. I think the statistical community should be involved in this, and I think you can do it a couple different ways. The first is I would encourage you, this is my little PCORI advertisement. There is funding at PCORI for methodological research. There's about 3 calls a year, RFAs. I'd be more than happy to talk to anybody that wants to apply there. I'm firewalled. That means I don't participate in the giving of funding at PCORI. I think this is a wonderful opportunity for community. There isn't that much methodological funding out there. Contribute to the discussion. There are communities discussing these standards. Use the standards. There you see a study that we're doing at Pitt right now on back pain, which is a PCORI funded project. And lastly, try to educate others about the standards. This was an Academy Health, which is a clinical researcher, health services research conference on how to use the PCORI methodology standards. I've been thinking a lot about, so I thought I'd throw this in, the learning healthcare system, if people have heard of this. This is really hitting, it's been around for a while, but the idea that we're going to be able to do pragmatic trials quickly, we'll have clinical data infrastructure across the United States, we'll be able to quickly use electronic medical record data and answer every possible question that we ever had. There's a couple problems with this. One is it's observational. The second is, if you've ever worked with electronic medical record data, it is a big, big mess. I've started working on it recently. I've got these 900 severely mentally ill people, and the person told me they had 200,000 visits in the last year. And they looked at me like, this made perfect sense. And I said, how can this be possible? You know, I mean, they're severely mentally ill in a bad way, but 200,000. So the data are not collected for the purposes. I see many nodding heads. We have experts in the room. But I think this is happening, and the bioinformaticians, at least in my world, have kind of taken over the data. You need to control the data, and I think statisticians need to be at the table. My other favorite story right now, I have a very earnest young informatician. We're part of PCORnet, which is the clinical data research network across the United States. PCOR is setting up these separate networks, and the idea is to put them all together. So he called me up and he said, I have the data ready for you, but don't worry about zip code. And I said, okay. He said, a lot of people were missing it, so I just put in 15217 for all the ones that were missing. 15217 happens to be the zip code where, you know, the School of Public Health is, UPMC. He said, so it's no longer missing, don't worry about it. And I said, well, actually, we would actually like the data with it missing. Well, why? Well, because that would be, so, you know, this different, totally different mindset. I have many friends who are bioinformaticians, but I think we need to come together with that community and be part of this kind of cyclical process of learning. It's very exciting to be there, actually, and see this working. So the learning healthcare system. So I'm going to go back. Evidence-based policy requires big statistics. I like these two quotes. Policy decisions should be driven by evidence, from Peter Orszag. And statistics is an integral part of public policy, from Janet Norwood. So my advice, don't forget that politics, the clock speed and the precision, that calibrate and synthesis, the word of Lowell Reed, evidence, you have to think about whose standards and from what direction are they thinking about evidence. When you're communicating, anticipate that spin. How, you know, try to put yourself in the head of the federal lobby. How are they going to look at these data? How's the FDA? And so on. Anticipate that spin. I am pushing these standards. I think it's an opportunity for us to impact evidence for policy. And the learning healthcare system is coming. It's here now. We need to be part of it. So what can we as individuals do? I think we can do big statistics. And more than that, I think we can teach our students to do big statistics. Communicate, collaborate, and lead. So I'll just close with a picture. There it is, the School of Public Health at the University of Pittsburgh, and say again how honored I am to have been invited today to speak with you in memory of Lowell Reed. Thank you very much. So I've left a little time. I hope that was okay, because I know people need to get on to things, but I'm also happy to entertain questions or comments. Oprah, yes?
So, you gave the example about those standards, what happens if you use one standard and you take a different standard to get different answers?
Yes.
What happens if you use one standard and I use the same standard and we get different answers?
Right. No, that's a very good point. I didn't go into as much detail as I would have liked with this project. Another thing we did is we looked at the standards and we asked the question, did they agree? Which is, you know, it's subjective. I mean, it's hard to do that. And then we asked the question is, are they actionable? And by that we meant, if you looked at them, would you know what to do? And that's hard because you have to think about, who are you? You know what I mean? Are you a trained statistician like us, or are you a clinical researcher? So I think there's, and some of them also allowed choice. You may do this or that. But I think it's an open question whether you would reach different conclusions. I agree to that. Yes, question in the back.
Thanks for the talk. So I have a question about use of data in policy decision making in terms of data-driven things.
Yeah.
So with that information, how do you, what are your suggestions or thoughts about how politicians involve in policy decisions?
Right. So it's a very good question. I mean, often in that case, in projects I've been on, we've been eliciting expert opinion. And there are processes to do that, consensus processes, the Delphi method, and so on. So to me, that would be a route to do that. But, you know, there's a lot of debate about whether that's biased or not. But that's classically what people do in those type of cases. Set up scenarios. The RAND UCLA appropriateness methodology is an example of that, where you actually present clinical scenarios and you ask different clinicians, what would you do in this case? Would you do a surgery or not? And that kind of thing. And there's ways to elicit information in a structured and somewhat reproducible way. So that would be my response to that. I think it's also important to say that there are not relevant, good quality data in this setting to answer this question. It's important to say that. When are we basing decisions on data, and when are we not? Because we do, in some cases, have to base it on no data, but that's important to know. So that's a good point. Other questions or comments? Yes?
Well, you started off by showing the classic statement where correlation is not a causation. What does the data analysis that people are working with are indicating that
right.
we see a high degree of association with certain actions that indicates from a policy perspective, funding and practice, that we should do that action.
Right.
And it's kind of like, you know, if we want more Nobel Prizes, we should feed people.
Right, exactly. Sounds good.
Yeah.
All right.
Can you say a little bit about how correlation has really kind of come to the forefront?
Yeah, and it has, and that actually kind of scares me. I sat in a room with I won't say which, health insurer, but one of the larger ones in the country, and they literally said, if I have 50 million or 20 million lives covered, why would I ever do another trial? That's a pretty bold statement. I think that's where the most important questions are right now, the very question you're answering. What I'm seeing in the studies that we're doing is trying to actually combine randomized with observational data. So I'll give you an example. I recently designed a study which was not funded, but it was a great idea. It was on obesity, and it had a set of folks that were randomized, but at the same time, I could easily follow a non-randomized cohort up together because I was already in the healthcare system, and it was easy to collect their data. And so the question becomes, how could you put those two together? What does the observational study afford you that the RCT does not, and could you adjust the observational study accordingly based on the randomized data? So I actually think that's the future, to combine the two. I don't think observational data personally will ever replace the RCT data completely. But that may just be my narrowness of the applications that I've been in. Yeah. But I think that's the question right now. Other questions or comments? Good. Well, thank you very much.
Please give another round of a hand to Dr. Sally Nguyen for the amazing lecture this year. She's fantastic.